Chapter 4 of Living Ethically, Skillful Speech. Quote, refraining completely from false, divisive, harsh, and senseless speech. End quote. Abstention from false speech is the only speech precept in the traditional list of 5 precepts, the Panchashila. In the list of 10 precepts, however, one of the Panchashila, abstaining from intoxicants, is left out and replaced with 3 further speech precepts and 3 mind training precepts, whose practice requires an additional level of awareness. These are ethical guidelines for Buddhists who wish to undertake a serious full-time practice of the Dharma. The emphasis on speech is very significant. In the West, the traditional division of our nature into mind and body, or body, soul and spirit. In Buddhism, the division is into body, speech and mind, according to which analysis our capacity to communicate ourselves is accorded an equal place with our physical being and our inner experience. As Buddhists, when we bow before a Buddha image, we do so by joining our hands and touching our forehead, throat and chest in succession, in this way connecting with the psychophysical energy centres or chakras at those points, which, according to the tantric tradition, are associated with, respectively, body, speech and mind. In doing this, we're symbolically offering the whole of ourselves to the ideal of enlightenment, as represented by the Buddha, without holding anything back. Speech brings together head and heart, intellect and emotion, body and mind, and of course, self and other. The speech precepts are not just about being truthful. One's speech should also be kindly and helpful, and it should bring about harmony rather than being harsh, senseless or divisive. These 4 speech precepts reflect 4 progressive levels of human communication. First, there is the level of simple truthfulness, of abstention from false speech, musavada. Next, there is the level of kindly or affectionate speech, of abstention from harsh speech, parusavacha. This involves being aware to whom one is speaking and being aware of their response. It should, after all, be possible to express oneself freely and cogently while at the same time considering the feelings of whoever one is addressing. As a baby, one knows one's mother only as a wonderful sensation of warmth and comfort, security and well-being. One is not aware of her as a person. When grown up, one often knows people in much the same way, but refined and rationalised. This is one of the reasons why there are so many misunderstandings between people. Much communication is pseudo-communication, communication between mutual projections. But speaking with affection is an attempt to communicate with a genuine awareness of the other person, quite apart from what they might be able to do for one physically, materially, or emotionally. Abstention from harsh speech in the course of a debate requires extra mindfulness because it is very easy to get carried away, especially if one is very articulate. Some people get more and more heated about increasingly remote aspects of the original issue until in the end, they're just sounding off, having entirely lost sight of the existence of the other participants and forgotten the context of the discussion. The third level of communication is that of meaningful and helpful speech, which is the positive counterpart of the precept of abstention from senseless speech, sampapalapavacha. Most people think that senseless or frivolous speech is relatively harmless. Those with no desire to become more aware will probably be quite happy talking trivialities for the rest of their lives. If you become more mindful, though, you will notice that while a little small talk oils the wheels of communication, a whole session of it can be quite draining. This is because, while part of you is caught up in the banter, the more serious part of you is frustrated. You feel that you've betrayed your better self, and the resulting sense of conflict will be draining. This is not to say that you need to be talking about the Dharma morning, noon and night, but that at the very least you should abstain from spending too much time on small talk. Aim to make sure that whatever you say is meaningful and helpful. The fourth level of communication is that of bringing about harmony between people, the positive counterpart of abstention from divisive speech, known as pisunavacha. This does not mean avoiding disagreement at all costs. It means speech that transcends selfhood, speech that leaves behind self-interest and helps to bring about a happier and more peaceful community. Between two or more people, the harmonious communication may culminate eventually in silence, a rich and living silence in which there is a common experience of self-transcendence. To develop this level of communication, one can begin by cultivating an awareness of a deeper and more authentic level of being in the other person, particularly in a spiritual friend, and most importantly, in one's spiritual teacher. Try to contact the real person behind the physical form, behind the words, and relate to what is deepest or highest in them. The fullest experience of harmonious speech takes place only between enlightened human beings, between whom there is no barrier of selfhood. Quote, "Just as by themselves the true words of kings generate firm trust, so their false words are the best means to create distrust. What is not deceitful is the truth. It is not an intentional fabrication. What is solely helpful to others is the truth. The opposite is falsehood, since it does not help." End quote. Ideally, a democratic government would tell the electorate the truth, but there are a number of reasons why this does not always happen. First of all, in a complex political or economic situation, the truth is rarely obvious. Even if all the facts are known, they do not necessarily tell you what is really going on. What you take to be the truth of the matter will differ from what others take to be the truth, and you will need to bear in mind the limitation of your own point of view. Secondly, people do not necessarily want to be told the truth, and politicians often have to tell the public what it likes to hear in order to win popularity. For example, people prefer a politician who claims to be in control of events rather than one who admits to being at a loss, which is perhaps understandable. Thirdly, in a democracy, politicians band together to win elections and then stay in power. They therefore have to put their party first, sometimes at the expense of their own conscience. They are obliged to toe the party line, to subordinate their own view of the truth of a situation to the collective interest of the party to which they belong. What politicians probably tell themselves is that paltering with the truth is the price that has to be paid if they are to do all the good things they've promised to do in their manifesto. It's a grubby expedience for the sake of achieving worthy ends. But such rationalisations are not convincing. The first aim of a politician should be to deserve people's trust, for once trust has been lost, it is irretrievable. What the public does not realise is that it asks, in effect, for untrustworthy politicians. It votes for people who are plausible and who will tell it reassuring untruths. It's only when there's a crisis that the general public insists on knowing the truth, and by then it's often too late. If you begin by telling the truth and go on telling it, you might have to spend a long time in the wilderness and not be believed in your own lifetime. But at least people will trust you to speak the truth as you see it, however unpalatable they might find it. The choice between truth and reassurance is often a hard one to make, but it's one that the spiritual life at bottom is all about. The spiritual life is a matter of seeking the truth and learning to live by it, whatever the cost. It is much easier to criticise others, especially politicians, than it is to conduct our own affairs in accordance with our professed Buddhist values. Speaking the truth begins at home. As Buddhists, our first duty in our capacity as citizens is to be straightforward and honest in all our dealings. Preaching comes a long way after that. In saying that the truth is that which is helpful, Nagarjuna is suggesting that truth is something more than simple facts. Truth is not a thing to be dumped on people. It is a truthful communication. Truth is non-deception in action. Facts can be known in a coldly objective way, but knowing the truth involves appreciating what those facts mean for people and how they connect with them. The time has to be right, the other person has to be receptive, and we ourselves have to be in a positive, kindly frame of mind. If the other person misunderstands what we have said or takes unreasonable offence, then we cannot really be said to have spoken the truth in the full sense. But even when speaking the truth causes pain, we have at some point to work our way round to it. We cannot indefinitely put off the day we actually speak the truth, the day we say what we really think. Let us be gentle and sensitive, certainly, and tactful if we can be so. But in the long run, it's only the truth that's going to help people, not a pleasant falsehood. The way to cultivate truthful speech varies from one person to another. The person who is liable to blurt out the truth without thinking, who talks first and thinks later, will have to learn to turn things over in their mind, while someone who is inhibited and tends to keep things back will need to be less fearful, less self-censoring. The idea that speech should be helpful implies that truth may be subordinate to the principle of skillful means. The classic example of this is the parable of the burning house in the Lotus Sutra. A father wants to get all his numerous children out of the house when it is engulfed by flames, so he tells them he has various toy carts for them and that these are waiting outside. The children run out of the house in wild excitement to find they've been deceived. The carts they hoped for are not there. But their father goes on to give each of them a far bigger and better cart than they could have imagined in their wildest dreams. The father represents the Buddha, of course, and the burning house represents samsara, the world wherein human beings are engrossed in their various games. The question is, how far should we take this story as a model for the communication of the Dharma? First of all, the story should not be taken literally. It's a parable. It's not an account of how a teacher gets people practicing the Dharma by telling them tall stories. It is about a father doing whatever was necessary in a life or death situation. We should be careful to be as open and direct as we can in our communication of the Dharma and not induce people to practice it by promising them worldly benefits of one kind or another as a result of their efforts. Even if they are expected subsequently to discover for themselves the limitations of those benefits as compared with the spiritual rewards of practicing the Dharma, the fact is that they will have been deceived. The deception does not relate to the material benefits, which may well follow, but concerns the nature of the transformation brought about by the practice of the Dharma, which is essentially a transformation of the mind, not one's material fortunes. Though we may indeed gain a measure of worldly happiness through our practice of the Dharma, that happiness should be less important to us than growth in our understanding of the Dharma. Thus, the parable of the burning house needs to be interpreted carefully. Higher spiritual experience is always going to be more than we can anticipate theoretically. It will always exceed our expectations. Reality is always infinitely greater than any description of it, and any description will, to that extent, be misleading. When you attain nirvana, is it going to be what you thought it would be? Of course not. But has the Buddha deceived you? No. It's just that you needed to be told something about it, even if what you were told was so utterly inadequate to the reality as to be, from the point of view of nirvana itself, a complete misrepresentation. When the father promises toys to his children, he is being as truthful as he can. One could say that the cart he finally gives each of them is the same as the little carts he promised, but on an infinitely grander scale. Much the same thing happens in the course of ordinary life. When you grow up, when you marry and have a child, are these events anything like what you originally envisaged? Almost certainly not. The same goes for when you receive Buddhist ordination, or yourself when you ordain someone. But were you deceived when you were told what to expect? No. All these events represent a breakthrough that could not be understood in terms of any previous experience. On its own much higher level, nirvana represents such breakthroughs. In the end, you can speak the truth in abstract, conceptual terms only to someone who knows it already, which means that it's not really a communication. We might therefore say that the truth is that which produces positive results, or which leads one in a positive direction. Returning to the first of the four speech precepts, abstention from false speech, we may say that it requires, as do the other precepts, that we pay attention to the subtle ways in which we evade their spirit. For example, we sometimes confuse objective facts with our subjective interpretation of those facts, without being aware that in so doing, we are misrepresenting them. Underlying this tendency is the assumption that our view of things is the correct one, an assumption that simply reinforces our confusion. If we are unable to accept that our perceptions are conditioned by our confused views and by our assumptions generally, we preclude the possibility of our ever changing our view. False speech often hides behind jargon. Instead of saying, for example, "He's not being open with me," or "I'm afraid she isn't very receptive," it might be more honest for one to say, "He or she does not agree with me." A failure to accept one's point of view might be because of a lack of openness or receptivity, but on the other hand, it might be due to a genuine disagreement, to the fact that the other person thinks differently. We must be careful not to evaluate when we should simply be describing. To assert that somebody is not being open can be a dishonest way of winning the argument and shows a lack of understanding of what openness really means. Being open does not necessarily mean agreeing. Someone can be very receptive to what you say and sincerely try to understand your point of view, but in the end, disagree with you. Conversely, someone might not really be open to you at all, but might agree with you out of politeness. Obviously, you want the other person to agree with you, but if they refuse to do so, it simply means that you've been unable to convince them. To misrepresent them by saying, to take another example, "I got a very negative response," amounts to false speech. Did the other person fly into a temper and hit you over the head with a chair, or did they simply disagree with you? The danger of using psycho-spiritual jargon like openness, receptivity, commitment, is that while our intention may be to use it to evaluate our mental states and cultivate positive ones, it can also be used in such a way as to put in the wrong someone who really does aspire to be open, receptive, and so on. As well as manipulating language, such jargon manipulates other people. It can be a kind of emotional blackmail, as if one was to say, "You want to be committed, open, and receptive, so why not agree with me?" Such jargon represents an extra layer of false speech for us to deal with. When someone says, "I'm sorry, I can't help you on this occasion," do you find yourself saying they are unwilling to cooperate, or do you report what they actually said, even though you might feel disappointed with their attitude and suspect that they're being deliberately uncooperative? Other examples of psycho-spiritual jargon include rationalization and projection. We know that these complex self-deluding processes do take place, and that they sometimes need to be taken into consideration. And this is what gives words of this kind their edge when they're used in an accusatory manner. The golden rule is to point out the possibly unconscious basis of what another person says or does only privately and tentatively. Say, "It may be my imagination, and I may be completely wrong, but this is what I think." At least give it some thought. Motives can indeed be questioned, but one should not try to rebut someone's arguments simply by questioning their motives, and certainly not by questioning allegedly unconscious ones. If someone disagrees with you, it does not necessarily mean that there is something psychologically wrong with them. At the root of the whole issue is the insistence that one's feelings about something should be accorded the kind of objective validity that one would not claim for one's thinking. Rather than say, "I think," or "this is my impression," one says, "I feel." Someone might say, "I feel that so-and-so is not very committed to the Dharma." And another person might point out that he meditates for 3 hours a day, lives in a single-sex Buddhist community, works in a team-based right livelihood business, studies the Dharma regularly, and helps out around the local Buddhist centre. But then the first person looks very thoughtful and replies, "That's true, but still my feeling is that he's not very committed." Apparently, one is expected to give to that feeling the status of an objective, evidential fact about the person being discussed. The confusion arises when it is assumed that another person's feelings cannot be questioned, because they are, ipso facto, only verifiable by them, whereas rational arguments can be challenged by anyone. If for an argument you substitute a feeling, especially an intuitive feeling, you thereby preclude the possibility of any rational discussion. For example, if you feel that someone's attitude towards you is very negative, the next question to arise is often not, "Where does this feeling of mine come from?" but, "Why does he have a negative attitude towards me?" If you go ahead and ask, "Why do you have a negative attitude towards me?" and the poor fellow replies, "Actually, I don't feel negative towards you," you can then point out helpfully, "Your trouble is that you're not really in touch with your feelings." Arguing in an emotional way can be a variation on this kind of obfuscation of the truth. It usually has the virtue of being artless, though there is a classic example that is by no means artless, that of the clergyman who wrote in the margin of his sermon, "Shout here, argument weak." The emotional emphasis with which a person says something tells us nothing about the truth of that statement. It tells us only about the strength of the conviction with which it was made. All this is part of the larger issue of false speech by default, or suppressio veri, suggestio falsi. Suppression of the truth, suggestion of falsehood. It might be appropriate to speculate about someone's motives, but subjective views should not be confused with objective facts. If you don't know the reason for someone's absence from an important meeting, for example, it would be false speech to remark, "So-and-so is failing in his commitment tonight." Underneath the layer of assumptions, there will always be a layer of fact. And that layer of fact is what you must get down to, however uncertain it might leave you as to how to judge a person or a situation. Quote, "From lying arises slander. From divisiveness, a parting of friends. From harshness, hearing the unpleasant. From senselessness, one's speech is not respected." End quote. Speech is the area of activity in which much of our ethical practice takes place. It is the first, and often the only, outlet through which our thoughts and feelings find expression. Nagarjuna's theme here is that when we speak unskillfully, we do not, in fact, get what we hoped for. He is pointing out that when we try to secure some kind of advantage at someone else's expense by telling lies, we get a poor return. The more calculating we are, the more we find that our sums just don't add up. So why then do we lie, for example? Lying often seems to be an easy way of getting the better of someone. But Nagarjuna reminds us that the advantage will be short-lived. If we tell lies, we are relying on people taking our given word for the truth, and that kind of trust is a priceless asset. But sooner or later, we will be found out, and our word will then be worth nothing, at least in some quarters. Moreover, telling lies creates an atmosphere of mistrust in which others may be afraid to speak the truth. When lies become the accepted currency of communication, truth becomes worthless. If, for example, we pass the blame for something we have done onto someone else, that person might feel that they have a right to do the same in their turn. It is likely, therefore, that at some point we will be made to bear the blame for someone else's misdeeds. We don't have to wait for another life in order to experience the consequences of our own unskillful speech. The same goes for other forms of unskillful speech. They too seem to produce consequences, karma vipaka, quite promptly. By divisive speech is meant tittle-tattle, backbiting, malicious gossip, creating dissension and disharmony between people, basically causing your friends and acquaintances to think worse of one another than they did before you opened your mouth. Maybe you repeat to one person what another person said about them, or you tell someone an amusing story that reveals something discreditable about a friend of theirs. In this way, you undermine trust and respect between people, and as a result, the dissension and disharmony you have created eventually engulfs you. If we have a criticism to make about someone, it is far better to make it to them directly. If we criticise others behind their backs, we might be surprised to find how often our criticism reaches the person criticised. We might not hear anything about the matter for a long time, but we can never be sure that we won't, and one day we might get a nasty shock, especially if the person in question turns out to have a perfectly good explanation for the conduct with which we have found fault. This can happen quite easily between friends if they have the kind of relationship that skirts around difficult issues. If they air those issues with other people instead of the person concerned, the result is likely to be a falling out and even a parting. In the case of harsh speech, we often find our unskillfulness reflected back to us quite quickly. Its painful effect is felt immediately, and we can therefore expect a swift reaction. We will at least create around us an unpleasant atmosphere, one that may even flare up into violence, and that will not easily be calmed down. If we engage in harsh speech, it is as though we expect others to bear it patiently, and they will not always do this. People might do our bidding when we speak harshly, but they will give us a wide berth if they can. The result of idle and useless talk is that what we say is not respected. If someone is in the habit of talking nonsense, perhaps to entertain or just to be noticed, in the end no one will take them seriously. Consequently, when they do talk seriously, they may not get the kind of attention they want. Other people will think, "It's only so-and-so babbling away as usual," and turn a deaf ear. But we should in fact make a point of trying to take seriously even people who are in the habit of talking frivolously. We don't know whether someone is chattering foolishly to avoid meaningful talk or to compensate for not being listened to in the first place. Moreover, a licensed fool is rarely a complete fool, and like King Lear's fool, they might have things to say that no one else is prepared to point out. One of the results of breaking precepts, particularly ones we break frequently, like the speech precepts, is that people start giving us labels. Acquiring labels and labelling others can be useful from a practical point of view. If someone is habitually late for appointments or is forgetful, or indeed is punctual or conscientious, it's useful to know this. But we have to be careful with labels, especially negative ones. Once they're applied, they can be difficult to remove, even when they're no longer appropriate, as in the case of someone who turns over a new leaf. Labels should be provisional, and it's important both to challenge the labels we ourselves are given and to question those we bestow on others. Otherwise, we are likely to have a closed attitude to the people we meet, and thus to block both our own development and theirs. Parents are particularly prone to see their grown-up offspring in this fixed way, wanting to see them just as they were when young. As a result, the offspring can find themselves reverting to their teenage selves whenever they go home on a visit. But we all have a tendency to burden others with our judgments, even to the extent of labelling them for life. Our fixed view of ourselves and of the world is based largely on our habit of stereotyping. For example, if someone is known for their rough tongue and bad temper, even if they're making a determined effort to be patient, we may not let go of our view of them. Maybe he's not showing it, we might concede, sceptically, but he's clearly still very angry underneath. If someone's effort to change are not appreciated because of such cynicism, they might decide that it isn't worth trying and revert to type. The same goes for the idle chatterer, or someone seen as lazy or irresponsible. Once they have a label, they may be stuck with it for life, unless they move somewhere else and make a fresh start. However, once you are determined to change, some labels can quite easily be removed. If you have a reputation for meanness, say, you can quite easily change people's perception of you by being so generous that they are sure to notice. If you tend to be late, you can make a point of always being punctual, and people will get the message sooner or later. Some labels, of course, are much harder to remove. One of the functions of the spiritual community is to encourage people to change. That is, we should try to see other people as individuals. An individual, a true individual, cannot easily be labelled or categorised. Ultimately, such an individual becomes free of labels altogether. People may try to label him or her, but their labels will not stick. This possibility has to be nurtured by a culture that does not feed our human tendency to label people. When we meet them, especially members of the spiritual community, it should be as though we met them for the first time, rather than seeing them on the basis of how we saw them in the past. Usually we don't know what conditions brought about our impressions of them, whether our own prejudices or the context in which we first met them. If we have only met them once before, we might have caught them at an uncharacteristic moment. Ideally, even in the case of an old friend, we should feel that we do not really know who we are now meeting. That attitude of openness in itself can make it possible for them to change. Quote, "Wisdom and practice always grow, for one who keeps company with those who speak advisedly, who are pure and who have unstained wisdom and compassion." Rare are helpful speakers, listeners are very rare, but rarer still are those who act at once on words that, though unpleasant, are beneficial. Therefore, having realised that though unpleasant it is helpful, act on it quickly, just as to cure an illness one drinks dreadful medicine from one who cares. End quote. Truth is relational. It depends partly, although only partly, upon who is hearing it. It follows that being able to hear the truth is just as important as being able to tell it. In a sense, they are different aspects of the same ethical practice. Nagarjuna points out that people who can listen to beneficial speech are rarer than those who are able to speak it. This is obvious, really, because it's easier to see the truth about other people than it is to see the truth about oneself, even if another is very ready to tell us about it. We tend to resist the truth about ourselves, even pleasant truth sometimes. As for helpful but unpleasant home truths, it is certainly easier for most people to give someone else such bitter medicine than to swallow it themselves. If an attempt to communicate was not a success, and we find ourselves saying, "I was only trying to be helpful," it may be that the other person was not receptive, but alternatively, it may be that we simply misunderstood them. It is difficult both to see the truth about someone and to communicate it to them in such a way that they can receive it. Above all, we need to be sure that we have their true welfare at heart, and that we are not simply speaking out of frustration or irritation. We can easily deceive ourselves in this regard. It is important that we communicate love and kindness and affectionate concern for the other person's well-being, as well as communicating the helpful truth. If you have or can develop the ability to hear truths that are difficult to accept, this is a great quality, especially in a leader. If you are able to put aside your immediate emotional reactions and rationalizations, you should take the medicine quickly, that is, accept the unpleasant truth and act upon it at once. It is easier to respond positively when you have known the person giving you the unwelcome information for some time. When they have demonstrated their affection for you time and time again over a number of years, you know that they can be trusted to have your welfare at heart, even if they speak rather bluntly.